dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And as we go.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva or WXXE Fenner, Syracuse. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Many people agree that there is a problem with the educational system. Many of the problems are ones of resources, which could be remedied immediately if the political will was there. However, education, schools, and the like exist as part of the fabric of a society that does not value people as individuals, only as consumers and commodities. There is a growing tendency to blame and criminalize children when it is the adults and the society that they have created that are the real problem. Schools are bent on churning out people standardized to the corporate expectation. And while schools have always stressed conformity over creativity, they have gotten worse in direct proportion to the extent that inquiry has been replaced by the advertising consciousness and form has replaced substance. Tonight we're going to look at schools and education from a variety of perspectives, environmental, political, and social. In our first hour, we're featuring an interview with the pioneer educator Jonathan Kozel and an alarming report on how toxics in the environment may be affecting the mental development of children. In our second hour, we have a documentary that looks at the trend of replacing personal attention with technology and why it is failing.
I don't know, good horse, as we trot in this dark here, that robbing the rich is for worse or for best. They take it by stealing and lying and gambling, and I take it.
The article that I'm about to read provides a context for tonight's discussion of education. Though the incident it reports on happened in Ontario, Canada, the climate in this country, what one might call the post-Columbine climate, has led to a number of school policies designed to further marginalize and brutalize the child who does not conform. In the post-Columbine flurry of editorializing, there was a definite lack of asking of the question, what is it about our society that causes young people to be so angry, so alienated? This article is from the Ottawa Citizen, Monday, January 8th, 2001. Writer jailed for his imagination. Lawyer defending teen imprisoned for fictional story about avenging bullies says, "We're in the middle of a hurricane here." By Aaron Sands. Writers, beware, your imagination could land you in jail. That's the warning from the lawyer representing a 16-year-old boy imprisoned for writing a fictional story in which a tormented teen plans to blow up his school to avenge years of abuse from school bullies. The North Stormont boy, who was 15 at the time and cannot be identified under provisions of the Young Offenders Act, was arrested in an OPP raid on his family's home 2 weeks after he presented an assignment to his grade 11 drama class at Tagui Secondary, a high school of 500 students in Avonmore, 20 kilometers north of Cornwall. The boy, who loves to write and calls Stephen King his hero, had been assigned to write a fictional short story and read it aloud as a dramatic monologue. His story, entitled Twisted, became the boy's way of pleading with the bullies who had been harassing him to stop their cruelty. A month ago, on December 8th, he was arrested and charged with uttering death threats. He's been held in custody ever since. We're talking about a very grave civil liberties issue here, the boy's lawyer, Frank Horn, said yesterday. Where does this thing stop? What are we going to be allowed to do anymore? Mr. Horn said he's received calls of concern from actors and writers across Canada since he took the case. This case has severe implications, Mr. Horn said, and people are very concerned. Does this mean writers will have to worry whether they're breaking the law with every sentence they write? Can their imagination break the law? We're in the middle of a hurricane here. Despite his parents' wishes, staff at the youth detention center where he's being held refused to allow the boy to speak to the citizen during a scheduled visit last night. The boy appears in Cornwall Court tomorrow morning for a bail hearing. 4 previous bail hearings over the past month were postponed. The accused spent his 16th birthday, Christmas, and New Year's alone and in custody. I'm going to talk to the Crown and tell them that the world is watching this thing now, Mr. Horn said. There is mass hysteria taking place north of Cornwall. The police cannot be dragged into this hysteria. They have to remain objective and investigate properly, but they've been dragged into the lies and exaggerations that have been taking place. After his presentation, students suggested the boy was playing himself in the monologue. Rumors quickly circulated that the boy had a hit list, bombs, and a plan. School officials questioned him, but he vehemently denied any plan of violence. The OPP, backed by a canine unit, searched the school and then his home. They found nothing, but arrested him anyway. The school beefed up security. Mr. Horn said the only evidence he's aware of against his client is the text of the story. The boy's parents said their son is gentle and creative, a boy scarred by several years of verbal and physical abuse by a group of bullies at school. According to his parents, a week before their son penned his story, a gang of 11 youths at the school attacked him. They said he was pushed to the ground and kicked repeatedly in the head. He had binders thrown at his face and returned home covered in dried blood. Mr. Horn said complaints by the boy's parents to the school and police regarding the vicious assault have gone unanswered. A gang surrounds this boy and attacks him like a pack of wolves, Mr. Horn said. The police need to investigate this. Instead, they've thrown the victim in jail and left him there. The boy's brother, 14, was also arrested. It's alleged the 14-year-old, who attends a different school, threatened to blow up 2 schools after his life was threatened by a gang of bullies on the school bus, shortly after his brother's arrest. The brother was charged with uttering death threats and is being held without bail. He appears in Cornwall Court today to have a trial date set. And that's what's taking place slightly to the north of us in the province of Ontario. That was an article from the Ottawa Citizen of Monday, January 8th, 2001, by Aaron Sands, writer jailed for his imagination.
In the wake of the Colorado school killings, there's been a frenzy of knee-jerk proposals, fueled not in small part by an obsessive media inundating us supposedly with every detail of the incident and the so-called investigations afterward. No one can look at the grief of the families and be unmoved, though one has to wonder why the major media feels the need to parade that grief in front of the nation twice an hour, or perhaps one doesn't really need to wonder why in the least. I myself have been extremely troubled by the constant reporting on every non-detail of the investigations of whether or not others were involved. It seems clear that the nation needs someone to scapegoat for the crime, and since the 2 main participants inconveniently eliminated themselves from contention, the effort has focused on the parents, a former girlfriend of one of the killers, and for a short time 3 young people who happened to be in the vicinity at the time of the murders at Columbine High School. The media whipped up the flames of a potential conspiracy and egged the public on with pseudo-reporting of what appears to be a non-story. The major media reported that these three young people were under investigation, as though there was some substance to why they were being investigated. They apparently had nothing to do with the crime, and their reason for being focused upon was the allegation that they were wearing camouflage clothing. Within an hour after reporting that these three kids were semi-suspects, ABC News was on the air again, stating that the three have been cleared of any involvement. If so, why bother to report the first story at all? It was a non-story in the first place. But in the rush to draw audience and to keep the tension high, reports on allegations and rumors suddenly become news. But more importantly, or at least to me, was the focus put on the former girlfriend. It appears that she bought guns that were later to be used in the Colorado killings, and the drumbeat began. She bought the guns. She bought the guns. She bought the guns. First, let me say that if she bought the guns with the specific knowledge that they would be used in a crime and that she facilitated the commission of that crime by purchasing the guns, she should be prosecuted. However, if she bought the guns with no knowledge of the plan, then to say that somehow she should be held culpable is ludicrous, and simply a blatant attempt to have someone to wreak vengeance upon. I also am, frankly, concerned that there will be an effort to set this woman up to be the evil temptress vixen that masterminded the whole affair. The situation in Colorado must be explained away somehow, and that would be convenient, not to mention grist for a great TV movie. It's happened before. Regarding the parents, I have no idea as to what kind of caregivers they were for their children, but until we discover that they were involved or somehow criminally negligent, we should be careful of what we want to hold them responsible for. When we begin to walk down the path of "you should have known, and since you didn't, now you'll have to pay," that's a road with huge pitfalls in it and one not easily traversed in reverse. In addition, it's important to note here that while the media brought what seemed to be every detail of the incident into our living rooms, there were glaring omissions in the coverage. Most importantly, that some of the kids at Columbine High School report that the so-called jocks had repeatedly abused students and that they were the ones who labeled a group of misfits the Trenchcoat Mafia. It appears from some reports, most notably in the British press, that the jocks ran roughshod on the students that they didn't like, including physically attacking some of them, and that this type of abuse was a common, if not everyday, occurrence at Columbine. It also appears that this type of abuse was going on for quite some time. No one, to the best of my knowledge, has asked the question, where was the school staff and what were they doing when this abuse was taking place? Because, as a few reports have stated, it appears that perhaps the two killers may have believed that the only way the abuse that was being visited upon themselves and their friends would ever stop would be if they stopped it. Now, I don't know if that's true. What I'd like to know is why the media does not report on every aspect of that part of the story. Perhaps it's because that this would call for something more than easy answers, titillation, and of course then the risk of lower ratings. I'm Mike Thornton.
Welcome to Bruderhof Radio, a bi-monthly program broadening the bounds of discourse on progressive thought and action. I'm your host, Andrew Zimmerman. This week on Bruderhof Radio...
It's always the people who send their kids to exclusive prep schools that cost $30,000 a year who ask me if you can really solve these problems by throwing money at them, and I always say yes. That's a great way to do it. Rich people who spend thousands of dollars on their children's education always look at me and say, Jonathan, is money really the answer? I always say, well, if it works for your kid, I think it's a good answer for the poorest children in the Bronx.
In mid-April, hundreds of Massachusetts high school students refused to take state-mandated proficiency exams, preferring to risk failure or even suspension rather than submit to what they felt was increasingly irrelevant and subjective testing. Meanwhile, New York and other major cities look vainly for qualified educators to administer their crumbling school systems, and in states like California, new prisons far outnumber universities. Added to that are a new generation of laws like California's Proposition 21, which criminalizes numerous youth activities under the guise of combating gangs. It's no wonder juvenile prison populations are on the rise. Displaying a crass disbelief in the capabilities of American youth, President Clinton recently expressed his support for the so-called school-to-work program, a state-based initiative that places high school students who seemingly show little aptitude for higher learning into service sector career paths. Whatever happened to equal opportunity? Sometimes it seems the only child Americans care about anymore is Elian Gonzalez. Providing a welcome change from this negativity is Jonathan Kozol, who, in a new book titled Ordinary Resurrections, explores some of the issues facing American education from a unique perspective. Kozol won renown for his work in previous books Amazing Grace and Savage Inequalities, which expose and indict the failings of inner-city public schools while still managing to portray the remarkably hopeful and vibrant lives of the children who attend them. Ordinary Resurrections brings Kozol back to the Harlem public schools he wrote of in Amazing Grace, but with far more personal intimacy than the often polemical tone of his previous work. To solve the educational problems of this nation, Kozol demands that we look towards children. His new book, Ordinary Resurrections, leads the way. In this interview with Ben Wright, Jonathan Kozol explains why he chose to write such a hopeful and energized book in a time when the American education system crumbles around us. In doing so, he responds to the issues of mandatory standardized testing and school-to-work programs that, he says, are typical examples of our society's loss of respect for children. I'd like to start out, if we could, just talking a bit about the book before we go deeper into some of the issues of education. Unlike your earlier books, and certainly more than Amazing Grace, this book is really a collection of stories, sometimes about some of the more mundane details of these children's lives in the South Bronx. And I'm wondering, why did you write this book? Why is it important for us to read?
I think a good deal of the writing and press attention given to inner-city kids, particularly black and Hispanic kids in the United States, tends to get stuck in the kingdom of labels in which our presuppositions about the types of kids we're talking about blind us to the actual details of their lives. There's a tendency to look at inner city kids and to almost force them to carry heavy weights of sociological labels, like the fashionable one of recent years, predator, or amongst those who really seem to have a low opinion of inner city children, super predator. They're described often as though they weren't really children, but premature adults or precocious criminals. We put these labels on them, and then if our research grant gets renewed, we come back 5 years later with a new label. And this whole industry of thinking up ways to categorize and slot urban children is very profitable for academic experts. Think tanks create entire empires out of thinking up new labels for children they basically dislike. I think it's a great mistake to do this, and I decided for the first time in my career to spend a lot of time with children without any prior agenda, without any presuppositions, without slotting them in any particular category. I just wanted to listen to them. I wanted to be with them and have fun with them and share the details of their lives. Now, all writers know it's very hard to do this if you have a pre-established outline for a book, if you're going to a neighborhood to get confirmation of particular ideas, it's very tough to do this, and most journalists have to do that, because when they go to a neighborhood, they're going there to get a story, and it's a specific story which has been determined in advance. I decided for the first time in my life I didn't want to have that kind of pressure on me. Going always to get a story means that you listen to kids, ever eager for the sentences which will support your agenda. I hate having to do that. The trouble with that is that anything that children say that's truly whimsical and unpredictable becomes wasted time. You're thinking, well, I can't use that. And I've seen reporters from very respectable newspapers make that clear with kids by looking terribly bored suddenly when the kid isn't giving them what they wanted to get. Mm-hmm. And then they will steer the child back into the area they were assigned. They'll say, let's go back to what you said before. And they're like, it's like they're shepherding the kids back into the area of pay dirt that will give them what their editor wanted. Mm-hmm. I hate doing that. A nun said to me there is a difference between getting and receiving. I wanted to leave a lot of time in which I didn't have to get anything. And as a result, I received much more beautiful and unexpected stuff than I've ever heard before. I think the difference here is that I spent a lot of time listening to these little ones. There's a chapter I call The Details of Life. And, you know, I often think that we waste so much time thinking in large categories and big words like despair, resilience, or whatever other terms we use. We sort of forget that most of life for children, as for most grown-ups, is made up of tiny little particles of joy or happiness. In the case of the little kids, it's things like licorice sticks and lighted yo-yos, which were in fashion while I was in the neighborhood, and maddening little computer toys that would squeak when they were in their pockets, little plastic butterflies, little translucent butterflies that little girls put in their hair, and these are the things they actually talk about. I'm a political person, and I hope we'll get to that. And this book does clearly have a political agenda, but I mean, which was sort of superimposed on the book while I was editing it, while I was drawing conclusions. But when you're with these little kids like Pineapple and Helio, Pineapple's a little 8-year-old book, and Helio's a 7-year-old. When you're with these kids, you're not thinking of big ideas like racial segregation or gross injustice. You're thinking of Winnie the Pooh or whatever book a child has just shown you. You're dealing with the little details of their lives, and they dominate this book.
In a way, it seems because this book concentrates really on the children's reality, and in many cases on the hopeful side of that, that perhaps you are now putting your stock in different things than you did back in the day when you wrote Death at an Early Age. Are you still fighting the political battle, and do you see hope in the political battle to make schools more equal?
If there's one difference now in my point of view from before, it's certainly that I pay far more attention to the role of religion in the lives of children. I think political activists and liberals in America made a great mistake by avoiding this issue for so long. There was often a sense among white liberals, at least, that they shouldn't talk about religion. And as a result, I think they left a vacuum which has been filled by right-wing forces, some of the extreme right-wing Christian groups, which exploit the gospel in order to trample on the gospel. I think this is our fault. I think many of us on the liberal and left side of the spectrum created that vacuum and basically left it to extremists on the right to appropriate the Bible. And I do feel now, if there's one thing I've learned from these years in the South Bronx, it's that religion is central to the lives and the moral strength of an awful lot of these families that I know, and I think those of us who are involved in social struggle and political struggle have to repossess the Bible and say it's our Bible too, and this is what it stands for. So that's a difference. But in all other respects, my political struggles are unchanged. As recently as last week, I was in Washington talking with some members of the United States Senate who have known me for many years about the gross, unacceptable inequalities of public school finance in America. I hammer at that issue. That has never changed. I still find it shameful that we have largely turned our back on the whole question of apartheid and no longer talk about residential segregation. Some days when I'm in the South Bronx, when I'm with the kids, in a quiet moment when I'm by myself, I'll just look around me and I'll think, my God, not a white child in sight, 99.8% segregated. I think is this what Dr. King and all our martyrs died for? So that anger has not changed a bit. I still am fighting the issue of school inequality on the most practical political levels that I can, supporting groups who are bringing court suit against several states, including the state of New York, to demand equal education for the poorest children of color. The kids I describe in the South Bronx, these little kids like Elio and Pineapple, get in reality about $5,000 a year spent on their public education. These are kids in regular third grades in the South Bronx. The New York Times sometimes says it's about 8,000, but in fact, head of the school system in New York told me at dinner a few years ago that those numbers are skewed and that what really gets down to a child in the third grade is about $5,000. That's what we're spending on a little boy like Elio, the poorest of the poor, in physically one of the most unhealthy ghettos of America. You lift Elio up in your arms and you plunk him down in a beautiful, wealthy white suburb of New York City out on Long Island, one of the wealthiest suburbs, and he'd be getting nearly $20,000 spent on his public education every year. Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know anybody, Christian, Jewish, or any other religion, who can look at that and find that acceptable. All religions say when people assemble in church or synagogue that all children are equal in the eyes of God, but they're not equal in the eyes of New York State or the eyes of the United States. They have price tags on their foreheads. Elio is priced as a $5,000 baby, and if we want to see a $20,000 baby, we have to go out to the suburbs. That, to me, is abhorrent, morally unacceptable, and theologically offensive.
This is Bruderhof Radio. If you've got questions or comments about today's program, call us toll-free at 1-800-778-8461. That's 1-800-778-8461. You're listening to Jonathan Kozol on Bruderhof Radio. Kozol recently spoke with Ben Wright about the so-called school-to-work program, which places high school students in service sector career paths, often denying them the opportunity for a college education. Kozol also commented on standardized testing, which is quickly becoming a bone of contention between students, teachers, and school administrators across the country.
It's interesting you mentioned putting a price tag on children's heads. It reminds me of something you say in your book in referral to the program Clinton's been supporting lately called School to Work.
Oh, I hate that program.
And you mentioned the name of a girl, Pineapple, who you said changed her career in her mind 6 or 7 times in the span of a few years. How is this program and other programs like it narrowing the opportunities for these kids and reducing their opportunities for higher learning and career?
School to Work, which is usually hyphenated, is highly specific to class and race. It's a targeted agenda. They are now bringing into public school at the level of 6th, 7th, and 8th grades, middle school. The school systems are now introducing the idea that students ought to choose for a career at that level. And so when they leave elementary school in 5th grade and they pick a middle school, they had to pick the school which specializes in the career that they have chosen, whether it's computers or medical services or whatever. None of these schools, or very few of them in the South Bronx, get kids into high schools, which will ever get them into college. So when they choose these career schools, they're not really choosing to enter any of these careers at a high level. I noticed that school officials now use the word train when they're speaking of inner city kids. They never use that word when they speak of their own children. They speak of educating their children. Nobody trains the daughter of a president of the United States for entry-level labor. We educate her, and she's a lovely child. She deserves it. We educate her to go on to inherit the earth, and Pineapple deserves the same thing. The kids in the South Bronx deserve the same thing. I also think it's an atrocity to look at any youngsters and tell them to choose a career when they're 13 or 14 years old. That's crazy. I didn't know what I wanted to be when I was 21 years old. When I left Harvard, I was probably 22 then. I had the slightest idea what I wanted to do in the world. I didn't even know when I was 28. I changed my goals repeatedly in life. Most of the people I find most interesting, like Thomas Merton or Dorothy Day, are people who had no idea what they wanted to do when they were young. Nor did St. Francis, for that matter. All the people who have enriched our world, transformed our vision of life, seem to me to be wanderers, people who leave a lot of time before they settle on a narrow slot in which they're going to take their stand in life. And I wish we could give the same freedom to these little kids that I know. You know, God help us if Toni Morrison or Langston Hughes or Martin Luther King had been told at the age of 12, hey, kid, it's time for you to choose a career. We're going to train you for something useful because we know you're not going to college. How impoverished would America be if we had done that? It would have been a sin then, and it's a sin now. It's rotten, and it shouldn't be done. It ought to be stopped.
Another aspect, I think, of this reducing children's lives to one career is narrowing them down academically through academic standards. Talk a bit about these academic standards, state testing, and what is that doing to these children?
There's nothing wrong with standards in general. I'm not a completely romantic, dewy-eyed liberal, even though I did come of age politically in the 1960s, and even though people like Thoreau are my heroes. I'll be quite honest, some liberals I've known are naive about this. You can't ignore the exams. They're there. They're a reality. Kids have to pass exams to survive in America. And God knows I had to pass a lot of exams to get into Harvard, and probably quite a few to get out. So those of us who have already benefited from succeeding in the competition of the that is endemic to life in the United States cannot scorn it for children of low income. We've got to strengthen them so they can enter this competition and win it. In that respect, I'm not against standards and I'm not against exams. And if rich kids are getting expensive private preparation for the SATs, which, as we know, wealthy people do in New York, their parents buy them an unfair advantage by giving them private programs such as Princeton Review, which are very expensive, to enable them to hit the exams. If rich kids get it, we ought to be providing that for poor kids too. So in that sense, I try to be realistic. I want the little kids I know to get into medical school. If they want to be pediatricians, then I want them to have that chance. At the same time, there is something crazy, obsessive, and unhealthy about the way the standards movement is being enforced. We are making these long lists of specific areas of knowledge, specific content areas that every child must know by the second month of the second grade or the fourth month of the third grade. Little tiny particles of amputated knowledge, a little fact that some alleged expert at a university in some city decides ought to be on the list. And so basically what's happening is that old people are summarizing all the things they learned in school and figuring, well, it was good for me, so we'll damn well make every inner city kid memorize this stuff too, and then we'll drill them to death for the exams. And there's something crazy about it. First of all, they keep making up new lists of standards, and they enumerate them tirelessly. They'll say there are 85 proficiencies that every third grader must know, and if she doesn't know it, she's not going to be promoted. And next year, they'll have another meeting paid for by some right-wing foundation, and they'll say, no, now it's going to be 122 proficiencies, and they'll list them. I have to tell you that it reminds me of the lists that psychotics make. There's something obsessive-compulsive about it. There's something bizarre about this sort of numerical fascination where these experts, most of whom don't know any children, are just sort of using up scarce funds to list everything in the world they can think of to make life miserable for teachers and to terrify children before the next exam. The fact of the matter is that equal standards for all children in America are a good idea, but to impose standards of equality without schools of equality is purely punitive. It is just a way of humiliating children whom we have denied the possibility to acquire these skills in advance. A society, a nation which really wanted to raise the standards of education for all children would not begin with the exam. We would restore art and music programs, because those are very good ways of stimulating children in general, even though they have no direct payoff on a reading test. We would broaden the curriculum. We would pour in the money. Rich people who spend thousands of dollars on their children's education always look at me and say, Jonathan, is money really the answer? I always say, well, if it works for your kid, I think it's a good answer for the poorest children in the Bronx. It's always the people who send their kids to exclusive prep schools that cost $30,000 a year who ask me if you can really solve these problems by throwing money at them. And I always say, yes, that's a great way to do it. I would pour money into these schools. I would divide the class size in half. I would make sure every child has access to a terrific library with a good certified librarian. I would make sure all these children have the same range of curriculum as they enter secondary school that rich kids have, including wonderful science labs and all the advanced placement courses in literature and foreign languages that rich kids take for granted. I'd do all of that for 10 years or 16 years, and then I would raise the standards. But to raise the standards first is brutal.
I just wanted to ask you about one thing, and that is that it has struck me as ironic that a number of the school shootings we've seen in recent years took place in very affluent neighborhoods.
That's right, in white neighborhoods largely.
Right. And I was just wondering, what's your take on that? How does that reflect on maybe a moral bankruptcy, where these inner-city kids are very different from the rich kids in this?
Well, I try to be very careful not to fall into stereotypes about inner-city kids. I hate the tendency to say, you know, that they have some kind of criminal predisposition, because I know that's pure racist hogwash. But I like to be careful not taking the opposite position and saying, oh, you know, the ethical destitution is out in the rich suburbs. I think we have to be careful about categorizing either wealthy or poor children or white children or black or brown children. Mm-hmm. I just think all these categories are wrong. In fact, there has not been any dramatic increase in crime amongst young people in the United States in recent years. despite the handful of dramatic incidents which have captured news attention. I mean, all, the little children I see are, by and large, as innocent as the kids that I grew up with in the 1940s in a nice little town outside of Boston. They have the same kind of sense of humor. They're very much. I taught inner city kids in Roxbury, that's the black community of Boston, when I was a young teacher. For 1 year, I ran freedom schools in the black community, and I also taught in a wealthy suburb of Boston known as Newton, Massachusetts, in the years when there was a liberal voluntary busing program. So I taught integrated classrooms in a wealthy suburb. And now I see these kids in the South Bronx, and I still visit affluent schools now and then. I don't think that most of the distinctions we make about these children hold water in any way at all. They have the same kinds of dreams, the same kind of delicious unpredictability. They're just kids, surprisingly sweet and beautiful children. Surprisingly, from the point of view of those who read too much sociology and don't know anything about them.
You've been listening to Jonathan Kozol on Bruderhof Radio. His latest book is called Ordinary Resurrections and will be published by Crown Publishing in late April. Bruderhof Radio is produced by Andrew Zimmerman and Ben Wright. For further information or to order tapes and transcripts of Bruderhof Radio, call us toll-free at 1-800-778-8461. Bruderhof Radio is a production of the Bruderhof Communities, a communal movement based on Christ's Sermon on the Mount, in particular the teachings concerning brotherly love and love of enemies, mutual service, nonviolence, and the refusal to bear arms. Money and possessions are pooled voluntarily, and in turn each member is provided for and cared for. For more information, call 1-800-778-8461.
If the latest developments regarding the religious right, schools, the Ten Commandments, and the overturning of the teaching of evolution in schools doesn't make you sit up and take notice, I just don't know what will. Just when it seemed that the religious right might have been defeated, they come back with a vengeance. I don't give a rat's butt about who or what anyone worships, and believe me, I've seen and heard some of the strangest beliefs you would ever want to know about. But, like I said, this isn't about my disapproval or approval of anyone's religion. It's about a group of people who want to shove their religion down everyone's throat and will stop at nothing until they do so. It's not about God. It's about control, and it's about power. We have these fanatics, and that's exactly what they are, forcing their religion into our public life. They're trying to drape their Ten Commandments in every public building that they can, and now they are demanding and unbelievably succeeding in having the teaching of evolution in public schools curtailed in favor of creationism. What's utterly dumbfounding about all of this is that one has to wonder whom the idiots are that are running these schools and why they are capitulating to these zealots. I can't resist throwing into this mix of religious zealotry Dr. I'm not really a Pharisee, but I play one on radio, Laura, who, in addition to her normal pious moralizing for profit, apparently suggested the other day that we would be better off as a country if the government declared martial law and posted soldiers on every corner. Of course, I'm sure that she would have that be Christian soldiers marching onward as to holy war. And the holy warriors are coming after whom? Well, they're coming after you. Bad boys, bad boys. What you gonna do when the vicious Christians are coming after you? My God. Have you ever noticed that, as practiced, Christianity has been the best friend the billionaires have ever had? There'll be pie in the sky when you die. The Christian church, when it has had undue influence and control of the secular government of kingdoms and countries throughout history, has a track record of slaughter and butchery. Can anyone say Inquisition? And they're up to it again. back in the Dark Ages, for the most part, the church controlled what education was available, and I think it's clear that they didn't use that power to enlighten the masses. And if you remember your history, anyone who dared to challenge the theories of the day could easily find themselves being scourged. If you don't know what that means, look it up. The church has sided with the rich and powerful for centuries, forgetting quite well the teachings of Jesus. Why? Because the church is part of the ruling class. They are huge property owners and money-making enterprises, and what protects the interests of the rich also protects their interests. I mean, the Catholics even supported Nazism, and while there are many street-level religious who work diligently on behalf of the poor and disenfranchised both here and in other parts of the world, they have often found themselves at war with the hierarchy of their own organizations, who were less than thrilled that any meaningful activity that would challenge the powerful was going on. Talk? Well, talk is fine. Just don't stir the masses up so they think that they have a right to justice in this life. I mean, frankly, if Jesus were to hear some of the things that go on in his name, he'd turn over in his shroud. Look, I've said this before and I'll say it again. These people are dangerous, and I mean really dangerous. I did a story on something called the Chalcedon Foundation once, and what they are is the theological rock that most of these right-wing organizations are built upon. They want the destruction of any form of secular government and want it replaced with the direct law of God. Now the question is, who is God? And who will interpret what God wants? Do you think it's going to be you? We hear talk about the Islamic Taliban in Afghanistan and how they're going nuts on the people with Islam. What do you think these folks will do if they're allowed to set up a religious government here? And that's what they want, nothing less. And they're not going to be content with letting people live their own lives. That's already been proved. The adage of the frog in the pot really applies here. When you turn up the heat slowly, the frog sits there until one day it's been boiled before it knows it. Doesn't it feel like it's starting to get a little warm in here to you? My name's Mike Thornton.
He must be happy. He must be happy. He must be happy in his world.
Children in Harm's Way by Rachel Massey. From Rachel's Environmental and Health Weekly, number 712, November 23rd, 2000. A new report by a group of physicians says that millions of children in the U.S. exhibit learning disabilities, reduced IQ, and destructive aggressive behavior because of exposures to toxic chemicals. Neurodevelopmental disabilities are widespread, and chemical exposures are important and preventable contributors to these conditions, the report says. Titled In Harm's Way, the report was written by physicians Ted Shetler and Jill Stein and two of their colleagues and was published by the Greater Boston Physicians for Social Responsibility in partnership with the Clean Water Fund. In Harm's Way links toxic exposures during early childhood or even before birth to lifelong disabilities including attention disorders, reduced IQ, and poorly controlled aggression. In Harm's Way reviews scientific and medical information on a range of toxins to which most or all American children are exposed and draws links to the rising number of children diagnosed each year with abnormal brain development or function. The report is a call to action for everyone interested in children's welfare and in the future of our society. To avert brain damage in growing numbers of children, we have to reclaim our government from corporate special interests, the report concludes. Developmental disabilities such as autism, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, dyslexia, and uncontrollable aggression currently affect an estimated 12 million children under age 18 in the U.S., almost one child in five. Furthermore, the incidence of some of these disabilities appears to have increased dramatically in recent decades. For example, nationwide, the number of children classified with learning disabilities and placed in special education programs increased 191% between 1977 and 1994. The number of children taking the drug Ritalin to combat attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD, has approximately doubled every 4 to 7 years since 1971. I'd like to interject that the reason the number of children taking Ritalin every year has doubled is because it is increasingly being prescribed, and I don't feel that this number should actually reflect the existence of a real disorder. Back to the article. I mean, the Ritalin situation is a whole other question entirely. Experts estimate that autism rates have risen from around 4 per 10,000 in the early 1980s to between 12 and 20 per 10,000 in the 1990s. According to a recent article in U.S. News & World Report, the number of children in New York classified with learning disabilities rose 55% between 1983 and 1996. Some argue that reported disabilities are increasing because of improved diagnosis and rising expectations as children are required to learn more complicated skills at younger ages. But many parents, teachers, and physicians who work with children think these explanations are only partially correct because they cannot imagine that such disabilities escaped notice in the past, the report says. Experts may argue about the exact number of children suffering from individual disorders, but the undisputed reality is that huge numbers of children currently suffer with serious developmental disabilities, and they are exposed to many toxic chemicals that are known to produce such disabilities. We believe we can no longer ignore the mounting evidence that chemical exposures contribute to the epidemic of developmental disabilities, the report says. In Harm's Way walks us through a sampling of neurotoxic substances to which many or all American children are exposed. Metals, lead, mercury, and manganese, nicotine, pesticides, persistent organochlorine compounds, e.g. dioxin and PCBs, solvents including alcohol, fluoride, and food additives, and reviews existing human and animal data on developmental effects of these chemicals. These effects can vary dramatically depending on the exact timing of exposures. Tiny exposures that would have no noticeable effect at most stages of development can produce devastating permanent damage if they occur during a window of vulnerability when certain organs are developing rapidly. Here is a sampling of the toxins that can misdirect the development of a child's brain. Lead exposure in infants and children is associated with attention deficit, aggression, and reduced IQ. Blood lead levels below those labeled safe by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency are associated with learning problems, and no threshold has been identified below which adverse effects do not occur. Young monkeys exposed to lead show symptoms including heightened distractibility and inappropriate responses to stimuli. 1 million American children currently live with blood lead levels above the threshold recognized by the EPA as affecting behavior and cognition. Millions more would be added to this list if the EPA's threshold were updated to take into account the most current science on the effects of lead in children. At low doses, mercury exposure can produce impairments in language ability, attention, and memory. At high doses, it can cause mental retardation, vision problems, and problems walking. Mercury enters the environment through waste incinerators and coal-burning power plants. It bioaccumulates in fish in its most toxic form, methylmercury. The EPA estimates that 1.6 million women of childbearing age eat sufficient amounts of mercury-contaminated fish to pose a risk of harm to their future children. Many pesticides kill insects by exerting a toxic effect on cells in the nervous system. Not surprisingly, such pesticides can disrupt the development and functioning of the human nervous system by the same mechanisms. Animal studies show that neurotoxic pesticides can produce permanent changes in brain structure and functioning when exposures occur in a single critical day of development. For example, some effects occurred in newborn mice if exposures occurred on day 10 of development, but not if exposures occurred on day 3 or 19. Short-lived pulse exposures may have devastating developmental effects, and yet can be difficult or impossible to identify after the fact. One pesticide exposure study examined children in two Mexican communities. The two communities were very similar in ethnic composition and culture, but one community practiced chemical-intensive agriculture, while the other used few farm chemicals. Children in the community with chemical-intensive agriculture scored substantially lower on measures of memory, physical stamina, and coordination, and had trouble with ordinary children's activities, such as drawing a simple picture of a person. Children in the pesticide-exposed group also displayed more aggressive behavior than their unexposed counterparts. Dioxins and polychlorinated biphenyls, PCBs, are organochlorine compounds that bioaccumulate in fatty tissue and are found at significant levels in human breast milk. Both animal and human studies show strong links between these pollutants and developmental disorders. Monkeys exposed before birth to dioxin in the range of human breast milk contamination levels were impaired in their ability to reverse a learned behavior in response to new stimuli. Young monkeys exposed to PCBs at levels typically found in human breast milk showed retarded learning as well as abnormally repetitive behavior. Studies of human children have found lowered IQs associated with PCB exposure in the womb, and a study of babies whose mothers ate PCB-contaminated fish from Lake Ontario found impaired development, including abnormal reflexes and startle responses. These are just a few of the studies covered in Harm's Way. government officials set safe exposure levels based on individual chemicals. But in the real world, children are exposed to many chemicals simultaneously. Such multiple exposures can be far more damaging than exposure to single chemicals. For example, one study found that certain combinations of pesticides produce changes in thyroid levels that are not observed when the chemicals are tested individually, and thus the combination may produce unexpected developmental effects. Proper thyroid levels are essential for brain development. Other studies reveal that exposure to a combination of mercury and PCBs, two pollutants that accumulate in fish, can produce even greater effects on neurological development than either pollutant alone. Under our current regulatory system, industrial chemicals need not be tested for toxicity before they are marketed. EPA estimates that somewhere between 2,400 and 4,000 industrial chemicals now on the market are neurotoxic. However, that number is highly speculative because most chemicals in commercial use have not been tested for neurotoxicity. EPA's Toxic Release Inventory, TRI, which covers just 625 out of 80,000 industrial chemicals, reported that nearly 1 billion pounds of known neurotoxins were released directly into air and water in 1997. Pesticides must be tested before marketing, but not for toxicity to the nervous system. Of 890 pesticide active ingredients, EPA believes 140 are neurotoxins. Some 20 million U.S. children under age 5 eat an average of 8 different pesticides on their food each day. The authors of In Harm's Way point out that there is no reason to delay protecting our children. We don't need more scientific information before taking precautionary action. We should not need to identify with certainty exactly how much and through what mechanism a neurotoxic pesticide impairs brain development before coming to the conclusion that public health is not protected when the urine of virtually every child in this country contains residues of these chemicals. We do not need to exhaustively understand the mechanism by which methylmercury interferes with normal fetal brain development contains cunt residues of these chemicals. We do not need to exhaustively understand the mechanism by which methylmercury interferes with normal fetal brain development contains residues of these chemicals. We do not need to exhaustively understand the mechanism by which methylmercury interferes with fetal normal brain development. Brain development contains residues of these chemicals. We do not need to exhaustively understand the mechanism by which mercury interferes with fetal normal brain development. Brain development contains residues of these chemicals. We do not to exhaustively understand the mechanism by mercury interferes with fetal normal brain development. Brain development contains residues of these chemicals. We do not to exhaustively understand the mechanism by mercury interferes with fetal normal brain development. Brain development contains residues of these chemicals. We do not to exhaustively understand the mechanism by mercury interferes with fetal normal brain development. Brain development contains residues of these chemicals. We do not to exhaustively understand the mechanism by mercury interferes with fetal normal brain development. Brain development contains residues of these chemicals. We do not to exhaustively understand the mechanism by mercury interferes with fetal normal brain development. Brain development contains residues of these chemicals. We do not to exhaustively understand the mechanism by mercury interferes with fetal normal brain development. Brain development contains residues of these chemicals. We do not to exhaustively understand the mechanism by mercury interferes with fetal normal brain development. Brain development contains residues kinds of these chemicals. What need we do not to exhaustively understand the which mechanism by mercury enters with fetal normal brain development. Brain development can contains residues of these chemicals.